Jim Cashin is here with me in the station on this May 9th, day after Mother's Day. He's going to be talking to me a little bit about what we both experienced on Friday in New York City, which was the funeral of Father Dan Berrigan. Jim, I want to say thank you for joining me here on the radio. It's good to have you up here.
You're welcome, Kieran. Good to be here.
Good. We happened to call your son, who is Chris Cashin, last week. Chris Newman and I got him on the air via phone. So he was just finished feeding the cows. And I told him to tell you I said hi. We don't know whether or not he did that.
He did.
Good. So good to have you now on the air. And tell us a little bit about Dan Berrigan and how did your paths meet cross? And who was Dan Berrigan and how long have you known him? Had you known him?
Okay. Probably sometime in the earlier mid-60s. So it's been about over 50 years that I knew Dan. And in those days, it was the anti-war movement that I was a part of as a resident of Rockville Center, Long Island, where my wife and I lived at the time. And we were against the Vietnam War and against our involvement in it. And Dan became known to me. I come from a Catholic background. My wife and I both do. And sometime in the 60s, I forget the occasion, quite frankly, I met him and got to know him and visited with him in those days in New York City, where he was living up in 90s, West 90th Street, in that area. And got to know him there, and also at retreats at Kirkridge Center down in the Poconos, and at the Pyramid Life Center upstate New York, run by Roman Catholic Diocese. And went to appearances, retreats with him, and actually visited him in jail, in prison. Several times he was arrested and went to the prison, and I forget now what the offense was, but I think he and his brother Phil were both in prison in Danbury, Connecticut. And I drove up there with others, as I recall, in the 60s, and met with him on a weekend and spent some time and visited him. And he was a special person in so many ways. He had a quiet charisma about him, let's put it that way, and very intense, but also at times very humorous. And started to read his books and became more interested in his beliefs and what he was preaching about. And became every year I would try to meet him somewhere, either in the city or more often than not at one of the retreats that he would give. And I also got to know his brother, Philip, and his brother, Jerry, both of whom preceded him in death. Philip in 2002 and Jerry in last year, 2015. And both of them, as probably most of the listeners know, were also activists. And Jerry up in the Syracuse area, Phil all over the country. Phil had also been a priest and Josephite order, and had left and married. I'm blocking all of a sudden.
I'm just going to interject for a minute here and remember the time where at the funeral they were recalling when I think Phil Berrigan was talking at their mother's funeral. Their mother, Frida, that's right. And they were honoring their mother somehow. and something about Frida saying, oh, maybe you'll remember, Jim, but he said something about, you know, in order to honor our mother, you know, she really would have been against this war as well. So, yep, I guess we're going to wrap it up and get going now because we have to go to the Pentagon and get arrested, which is what they did to honor their mother right after the funeral. They went to the Pentagon to protest the Vietnam War and got arrested. I thought that was a very typical sort of anecdote about the Berrigan brothers. And
they always did it, though, with planful way. They and whoever was going to participate in the program or the action that they took would meet, and they would talk about what they were doing and why they were doing it. And people brought various thoughts to the table. Dan's thinking, if I am correct in summarizing it, was that this is what the gospel message, as he understood it, required of us, to be present and to live out the message of the gospel of Jesus as he saw it, especially as it related to the social environment and government and the role that we all play, should be playing. And so we would meet on those occasions. And then, as I said, at the various retreats that I would attend, probably in all 20 to 30 retreats that I attended, the Dam either gave or participated in.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of retreats were these, or what kind of things would folks be talking about? Because we're not just talking about war here.
No.
What sorts of other things was Dan standing up for?
Well, certainly civil rights, and but it was mainly the peace movement. And he did get active in other things too, I'm sure. But mostly, as I knew him, from my context, was the peace movement. And he felt very strongly, obviously, about that and was willing to go to prison for his actions that he took, knowing that he was going to probably be arrested and charged and tried and probably convicted. And he made no pretense that or no defense things charged, but said that there was a law higher than the federal laws in his mind. And he believed that he was following the higher Lord when he did the activities to try to raise attention. He never thought, as I understand it, that he was going to stop the wars that he protested against. But rather what he wanted to do is to prick the consciousness of people who were concerned in varying ways and to give them some substance to chew on regarding why the war was not the answer and violence was not the answer. So, and he conducted the retreats usually. Sometimes he would lecture, but on the retreats he would usually talk about passages from the Old Testament or New Testament, from which he drew lessons about civil action and civil disobedience and what Christ did and what, as he understood it, Christ was asking of people who felt the same way. And he would talk and give it back, but then he would ask questions. He would ask questions of the audience and try to get them to articulate the reasons that they had been attracted to the movement. And he was generally successful. So people who initially just wanted to hear him were drawn into it. And I think in that way really brought them to the table in a more direct way and involved them in a more direct way. And in addition to the retreats, I went to certain of the actions which he held, one of which I remember down in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where people burned draft cards. And then, of course, annually there was from the 1980s on, I think, There was a walk in New York City from the east side around the UN over to the Intrepid, the aircraft carrier Intrepid, by people from everywhere. And that walk, which up to 1,000 people would march across the Manhattan and stop and did the reenacted the Stations of the Cross as they might apply to the surroundings that we walked. So they would stop at the some of the federal agencies that participated in what Dan and others felt were inappropriate activities. And we would pray, and we would march, and we would hand out information to people. And then we went over to the Intrepid, and people who chose to would cross the line over there. They had the federal officials would draw a line and said, you can do your actions up to this line, but if you cross over, you will be arrested. I was arrested once, chose to go beyond, go over that line. And by that time, this was in the 90s, I think, or maybe into the 2000 years. This was an annual thing, and people knew what was expected and knew violent activity. So, and the police were usually Irish Catholic, or many times were Irish Catholic, and got to know Dan over the years, so that it was a very convivial happening oftentimes, although still very serious. And when I participated, the people who did cross the line, probably 10 or 12 of them, of us, were arrested and taken to a lockup in Midtown and processed and released. And I think 2 or 3 weeks later, we went down, called to a hearing down in the Broadway somewhere. And I pled guilty. And as I recall, there was no real punishment at the time. But you did have to stand up, and probably I have a record somewhere.
Well, the Intrepid is actually still down there on the west side on the river there. It's a museum, and there we drove by it on the way out, and they had giant banners proclaiming it's remembering Vietnam Week or something like that at the Intrepid Museum. It's an aircraft carrier dry docked right now in the west side of New York City, with all these bomber replica or former bomber planes on the aircraft carrier, where families bring their little children to ooh and ah over the birds of destruction. And John was actually mentioning how people who, you know, men who flew those planes in Vietnam from the aircraft carrier, the Intrepid, never ever saw one iota of land in Vietnam, or one person. So they would literally fly there. They would literally sail out, you know, miles and miles off the coast of Vietnam, send their plane over to unload its payload of bombs and just bomb the heck out, fly back, land, and have a six-pack of beer. And then when their deployment was over. They never actually even saw Vietnam. That's how a lot of the destruction in Vietnam actually took place, with people not even really knowing what they were doing.
Yeah, or not personally knowing it.
Right, right, not thinking about it at the time necessarily, some of them. And I just thought that's such an interesting concept to not really know. So the Intrepid. So you were there with Dan, crossing the line, getting arrested. Dan many times getting arrested and actually was wanted by the FBI at a certain point. He didn't show up. And then they went after him, and he went underground for quite a while there and surfaced here and there, giving talks, surfacing in living rooms, being hosted by folks.
And surfaced finally over in Block Island.
Is that where they nabbed him, right?
At the home of William Stringfellow, who was a professor at a Boston college. I'm not sure which one. Bill has long since died, but he gave Dan his place, and that's where he was arrested. And it's for me, talking about Dan brings into mind Philip, his brother, who was oftentimes a leader of these events. That he was much more of an activist than Dan was, although they both were very active. But Phil wanted to do the demonstrating and the action as much, and so he was often the leader of these, and Dan was a very willing participant, but Phil would oftentimes take the lead. And there was a group of people, including your stepfather, who were known as the Plowshares, who did a number of events around the eastern part in Pennsylvania and New York and elsewhere, actions proclaiming opposition to the Vietnam War. And you can probably tell stories about, although he was not your stepfather at the time, I don't
imagine. He was not at the time, but that's where my mother met him, was in prison, actually.
Yeah.
So, pretty amazing story there. 1980, there's a document or movie called In the King of Prussia that was redone basically using the transcript of the trial and all the defendants, including Dan and my stepfather and the others, playing themselves using the transcript. And Martin Sheen, who is a dear friend of Dan Berrigan's, plays the judge. A very young Martin Sheen. It's pretty amazing to see Martin Sheen as the judge, this stern sort of guy. And it's a wonderful, wonderful film, In the King of Prussia.
Yeah, many years later, one of the demonstrations was held down in King of Prussia, recognizing the action that had been taken years before. And my wife and I, and my wife Meg, and I, Meg would generally attend the events, and oftentimes I would try to bring my children to try to educate them as they became older and could understand better what we were doing and why we were doing it and why it was important, to us at least, would come to these events. And Dan and Phil would visit us up at the farm out in Claverick and at times, and brought them here to speak at various times to church groups and general community several times, and also became involved with his brother Jerry, who was another activist, peace activist, who had remained in the Syracuse area where the Berrigan brothers grew up. There were actually six brothers, and Phil was the youngest, as I recall, and then Jerry and Dan, and then the older brothers. Mm-hmm. So we got to know both Phil and Dan, and then later on, Jerry, who died last year. Again, had history of actions and civil disobedience and spent time in prison.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was often, there's a book, one of his books, and Dan was the author of 30 to 50 books, some of which were poetry, others were not. And he would write about why he was doing this when there was no outcome, observable outcome, in terms of changing what the policy of the country was, at least in the short term. But Dan did it because he felt that we were all called to reflect on what was happening in society, and to speak out where there was violence or violent activity.
Absolutely, which includes American Empire. We actually have a caller calling in right now who we both know. So I'm going to try to go to the phones here. And I'm here with Jim Cashin in the studio. We have John Shushart on the line. John, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Thank you for calling in. We're talking about Daniel Berrigan, the funeral on Friday, and the life and legacy. And Jim's sitting here with me in the studio, John.
Hello, Jim.
Hi, John. Good to hear your voice.
That was an extraordinary, historic gathering and funeral, one of the most inspired, spirit-filled events and gathering of family and community that we're likely to experience in our lifetime.
I would agree.
Yes, more than 2,000 people, and
was it that many?
Inspired by the spirit of peace, the need for abolishing nuclear weapons, and ending the drone murder program, the drone assassinations, the invasions of other countries, and a spirit that was ignited by the Catonsville Nine and carried forward through the 95-year life of Daniel. Today's his 95th birthday. And Phil, as you mentioned, and Jerry, and, of course, Elizabeth McAllister, Phil's wife.
Right, right. It was great seeing both Liz and also Carol Berrigan, Jerry's wife, who was very much involved, both of whom have been very much involved in the activities, especially Elizabeth.
Yes. You know, I thought, really, this so much was said about Daniel Berrigan, but the real subject is the Holy Spirit and family and relationships and community. All that was so manifest there in that tremendous resurrection, mass of the resurrection and celebration and upholding of all of that, of Dan and Phil and Jerry and family and community and the Holy Spirit.
Well, as you mentioned, it was filled with very special moments. The 2 hours, the march over to the church, St. Francis of Xavier Church in West 16th Street, and also the mass itself and the speakers. And I think it ended on such a wonderful note with the Dan's nieces and nephews talking. We're asked to come up and reflect on Dan's life and his meaning to them. And they talk so beautifully and poignantly about Uncle Dan, as they refer to him. And Liz was involved in that discussion, too. And it just gave you such hope that not only we who have now reached the seventh or eighth decade of our lives were able to bring along people, or some young people at least, who were understanding what had happened and Dan's, the importance of Dan's life, and hopefully challenged to do something in their own lives.
Exactly. That was the message that Father Steve Kelly certainly delivered, and Elizabeth McAllister certainly delivered, that this the whole burden and meaning of this mass of the resurrection is we are responsible, and we must act in the face of the cataclysmic continued deployment and threatened use of nuclear weapons around the world, and the invasion and destruction of one country after another. Iraq left in burning, bleeding ruins, and Afghanistan in burning, bleeding ruins. Now Syria in burning, bleeding ruins, all as a consequence of U.S. NATO invasions and terrorism.
Could I ask a question, John? Just one similarity, aside from being shackled to Dan Berrigan at one point, I believe. You have in common this idea of standing up to justice, standing for justice, and willing to be arrested for it, of giving up the comfortable life of either a middle class American or a Jesuit priest without bothering anybody, without offending anybody, you know, making this decision where he decided with, you know, that maybe it will offend someone, maybe it will cause a stink or bother somebody, but I do need to burn these draft cards with napalm, or I do need to go into General Electric and hammer on the Mark 12A warhead with you. How do you come to a decision? How could you, if you could speak for Dan, but also yourself, how would you say he came to that sort of, would you call it an epiphany, a conversion, or would you just speak to that sort of idea of dedicating one's life, is it from one day to the next, to a life of peace and radical peace at that?
Yes, well, I think conscience and the human inborn capacity of compassion, when you see the suffering inflicted by drafted men, conscripted, sent against their will to carry out the destruction of a poor, defenseless people like the beautiful agricultural people of Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam, or when you see preparation for the genocidal weapons of course, nuclear weapons, they're not really weapons. Our language fails. They're genocidal. We're 70 years after Nuremberg. A single Trident submarine makes Auschwitz look like a rusty antique. The ovens are being prepared to be transported to the people rather than using those old antique railroad cars to transport people to the ovens. So I think the facts that are facing us, the reality that is facing us, compels us to action. As Daniel said during our Plowshares 8 trial, the name of our crime is responsibility. Somebody must undertake responsibility for this madness. And, you know, none of us want to be arrested. And we go into court hoping that the law will carry out its function of serving the common welfare of ourselves and of humanity, and will uphold the Constitution, the United Nations Charter, the Law of Nuremberg, that is so explicit that you cannot prepare crimes against humanity. And of course, a nuclear weapon is the summation of all crimes in the extreme. The term genocide has been noticed to be too weak. So that a new term, omnicide, nuclear weapons are the end of all life. They are the killing of all life, omnicidal weapons. And we must act, and I hope that that's the resurrection message that came out on Friday from the Mass for Daniel Berrigan, that we must act, and time is running out in the world seated with these omnicidal nuclear weapons, and not one step to dismantle them. You know, and we have to face the reality that our legal system is collapsed, that our courts and our law have become more than meaningless. They've become criminal. They arrest and imprison a gentle poet like Daniel Berrigan for years, Phil Berrigan, Father Philip Berrigan, for the simple, most simple nonviolent act. About the same as lunch, sitting in at a lunch counter, and he spent 11 years in prison. Father Stephen Kelly, one of the most gentle, humane human beings you'll ever meet, has spent 10 years in prison. Father Carl Cabot, for entering missile silos out in the Dakotas, 18 years in prison. So our law, unfortunately, has made a mockery of the law, and it turned its back with total contempt on the Nuremberg decisions, and is acting on behalf of nuclear omnicide. It's the same position the law took during the enslavement of African Americans. The law has become corrupt. The law has become a vehicle of injustice, and is prepared to seal the doom of humanity until they respond to the plea of the hundreds of people now who have undertaken Plowshares actions and been made every effort, as we did, to present our defense with legal experts, with nuclear weapons experts, with scientific experts, and been denied again and again the opportunity to present the evidence before our peers, before our the juries of our peer, where the prosecutors and judges work hand in hand in glove. No neutrality on the part of the judiciary. They simply say whatever the scientists produce in the way of annihilation, they will authorize. They will uphold and defend and send people like Dan to prison silence them as best they can. So we all need to be aware of just how collapsed and corrupt our judiciary and our legal system is.
Interesting commentary there, John. Thank you so much. And I was reminiscing with Jim Cashin here also about the welcoming, or Jim, it might have been just before you came up in here, about the family sending the memo to all the FBI agents at the funeral assigned there that day to welcome them as well and let them know that they can finally close the file on that case.
Well, there again, you see the collapse of our governmental system. How the FBI, which is supposed to protect us from crime, would be devoting personnel and resources and years and years and years to following people like Daniel Berrigan or Martin Luther King or Father Steve Kelly. You know, the work of suppressing and spying on and infiltrating and, you know, creating a more and more dangerous situation for the family instead of creating security is a scandal. It's a scandal. And yet Congress has never investigated this, never condemned this, said that the FBI must protect and must not harass and intimidate and so forth and build false evidence against the most moral, peaceful priests and nuns. Sister Megan Rice, at the age of 82, sentenced to 3 years in prison for simply walking into the nuclear weapons facility at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. You know, the FBI hounding her, imprisoning her in the most deplorable conditions. These scandals have got to be brought to light.
Well, Jim, you made a very interesting comment about the hopefulness of the new generation coming up, and I'm wondering if I could hear from both of you. Maybe you want to repeat that again, Jim, or say that again a little bit about, or let me just ask you, how can we give the next generation hope? You are now the grandfather, and you are too, John, of many, many countless grandchildren. I don't know. I can't count them anymore. Many grandchildren. How do we bring these kids up in this modern era facing all of these difficulties compounded times 10, I might add, in hope and optimism for peace and social justice? Jim, if you want to answer that.
Sure. I hesitate because there's no easy way of doing it. I think by our presence and our conversations at dinner time and what we focus on in the news and how we attempt to challenge our children to, as they become young adults and then older than that. In my case, my 9 children are now between the ages of 41 and 55. But take every occasion we can, where it's appropriate, to ask them what they're doing and ask them their thoughts in the country and the world. And you know, create the opportunities for reflection on their part. And then, of course, using the examples of Dan and Phil and Liz and all of the ones we've talked about, and to want to do these things in spite of the knowledge that there will be no immediate impact, probably, on their actions in terms of changing the policies. But the need to educate the children, the young people, the other side of the story, I think that they learn in school at times about activities, that demonstrations and civil disobedience. But I think when they learn it from and they understand why their own parents or grandparents are doing something and listen to that and are willing to do it without any, as I say, real hope of any immediate success on it, always hoping that you will be changing individual minds and gradually over a period of time collectively changing the beliefs of a larger part of society, but not doing it for any kind of immediate success, which I think is oftentimes hard for some people, whether young or old, to embrace something that's not going to lead to anything immediately.
John, what do you think?
Well,
is there hope for the children?
Time, so
we are.
If it doesn't lead to immediate success, you know, we can pretty much start writing the obituaries for our grandchildren now. We are living on borrowed time. The world almost went up into smoke, in 1962. And now that everything is so subject to satellites and computers and electronic vulnerabilities, the chances, and you know, that's why the nuclear clock has been moved to 3 minutes to midnight. This is one of the most perilous times that humanity has ever faced. And, of course, with most people asleep, there's no cause for optimism. I think it's important to distinguish between optimism and hope. And there is no basis for optimism. But hope is something that that we are, you know, that's a gift that we live, a gift of the Holy Spirit, the gift of community, the gift of family that Jim talks about, family and friends. And it was interesting that Daniel, always when he met with a group of people, he always ended with a circle asking everybody in that circle, what gives you hope? Because each, while we draw a breath, we each have sources and inspirations for hope. And we must live from that hope. But it doesn't mean miss whistling in the dark and being optimistic and think, well, we're going to get along just fine. The path we're on is an either-or path, descending into ultimate total destruction, or a turn towards a nonviolence of love and recognizing our humanity. And what so many people testified to at Dan's funeral, what gave them hope? Dan Berrigan gave them hope. Phil Berrigan gave them hope. Liz McAllister gave them hope. Because they took responsibility. They entered the nuclear weapons factory. They disarmed nuclear weapons systems, B-52s, Trident submarines, ICBMs, Mark 12As. That Jackie Allen said how despairing she was as a teenager growing up, thinking about the ultimate day after doomsday, until she learned about Daniel Berrigan. That gave her hope, and then she began to change her life, take actions, enter nuclear facilities, stand. But this is not going to change without people undertaking the kind of witness that Daniel set forth in Cadenceville. Faith without action, the scripture says, faith without action is dead, absolutely dead. So that I think, is a very stark message that we need to take and not sugarcoat the situation we're in or create any sentimentality around the sacrifice of Phil's 12 years in prison or Steve Kelly's 10 years in prison or Father Cabot's 18 years in prison or Dan's nearly dying in prison. These sacrifices must not be in vain.
Indeed, indeed. Well, you're right, John. We are running out of time. And as always, we really appreciate your perspective and contribution here on the afternoon show.
Well, thank you for honoring Daniel Berrigan. It was wonderful to be with you, Jim and Kieran, at one of the most extraordinary historic gatherings of our times.
Indeed. Thanks, John. And I want to thank you too, Jim, for making it up here to the studio right here in your backyard. You're right over at over in Claverick, local resident of Columbia County for many, many, many years now. And thank you for joining us here on the Monday afternoon show as well, Jim. And much love to all of your family, which hopefully maybe some are listening.
Well, it could be. Could be.
Could be.
And Kieran, thank you for inviting me. I was honored to be invited and honored to talk about an event that had a big impact on my life and my wife's life, Meg, who joined me on last Friday and in the participation in the liturgy and presence at the at the demonstration.